And what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the program. It is episode 411 of Not Your Average Boston Sports Podcast. I am your host, Garrett Hayden. Great to be back with you folks this week. I got a great week for the podcast. This week, I want to say thanks to everybody last week that submitted questions for the mailbag. It was definitely an enjoyable mailbag episode last week. So obviously, a big thank you to everybody that submitted questions. A lot of you that submitted multiple ones, really appreciate that. So that was definitely a fun, enjoyable mailbag last week. Very excited about the program this week. We obviously got a lot to get to today. Maybe a little bit shorter in terms of some off-season stuff with a number of teams. There's not a whole lot to get to, but we'll definitely get to a lot of Bruins and Red Sox today. But we are looking forward to Guest Friday later this week. Got a couple returning guests. Be talking PLL, so that will be very fun. Looking forward to that later this week. But I think for today, we are going to start with the Boston Bruins, who have recently hired a new head coach. Marco Sturm is the 30th head coach in the history of the Boston Bruins. Bruins announced that late last week, so luckily, actually, we were able to discuss it on the mailbag last week. A couple people sent in some questions about Marco Sturm. So obviously, if you've heard the mailbag episode from last week, I'll probably be touching on a lot of the same points. If you have not listened to the mailbag, please go listen to it. But if you've not been able to, I can give you, kind of just my initial thoughts about the hiring. I think throughout the process for me, I kind of was always hoping for the Bruins to kind of take a chance on somebody and go outside the organization the best way they can. Now, I'm going to get this out of the way right off the bat. There are a lot of people that are saying that, Marco Sturm is, or that this hire is like, that people think that they're just hiring somebody that they know, and it's like that it's something like that. And I'll be honest, like the only connection that Marco Sturm has is that he played for the Bruins. There's no other connection. Never worked for the team, never, was involved in any kind of front office position, never coached in Providence, obviously never coached with the Bruins in an assistant capacity. So I don't really understand where we're getting this thought that he's just another, same old hire. The Bruins are, not going, outside the organization. They are. Like anybody telling you that Marco Sturm is just like, oh, another, Bruins guy, it's just like it's incorrect. Like he played for the team for 5 years, of course, but it's like he has coached in the LA Kings system for years, has been an assistant coach in LA, was the head coach of the AHL franchise, also coached Team Germany at the 2018 Olympics, which was I think, yeah, the Olympics that took place without the NHL players. Although for some reason I'm not remembering 2022, but anyway, coached Team Germany at the Olympics in 2018. And I don't know, I feel like there's no connection to the Bruins. It's not like he's like Bergeron or Chara, who like have stayed around the organization since they retired. It's not really the case. And I just feel like it's a little bit of a low-hanging fruit that people are doing, that it's like, oh, well, Marco Sturm played for the Bruins. He's just like a person that, they know the best. It's like, do they know him because he used to play for the Bruins? Yes. But he's never coached for the team. He's never been involved in any, front office position. So that just is kind of a bizarre talking point to me. But I do think, he's enough of a outside the organization hire that I think makes sense. I think somebody that's worked in depth in another organization, and I think that organization, the Kings, I think has had a good track record in the last couple of years of developing young talent. And I think the Bruins are hoping that Marco Sturm can be that guy that does help some of those young guys kind of, find their ceiling. The only concern that I have is this is what was said about Bruce Cassidy. This is what was said about Jim Montgomery. And obviously they're no longer here. And so it's like, I don't know, at what point is, that going to not be what keeps Marco Sturm here, but that's a discussion to have for another day down the road, and hopefully, we don't need to have that conversation 3 years from now, but we'll see. But I think, looking at the Kings and their ability to, integrate some young talent, as they talked about on the mailbag episode, could give you a little bit of hope that the Bruins can do kind of a similar sort of thing and, give opportunities to some of their younger guys that should be pushing, for roster spots. So, that's one area that I think this is a good solid hire that, Marco can work with some of those younger guys that are trying to make an impact. I think it is interesting that, he coached that 2018 German team. Obviously that was a Olympics without NHL players, and so got to think there were some younger guys on that team, and I think did a pretty impressive job, and obviously he's been with the Kings organization for a number of years, so I think that's one part of it that I'm interested in. I think the other part is it's kind of a defensive-minded coach, wants to play with structure, and I think the Bruins had a lot of issues last year with defensive coverage, even with McAvoy and, for the little bit that Lindholm was healthy, had issues with that. And then obviously when both of those guys are out, having to play Zadorov and Peak as much as, they probably did have to play this past season and probably didn't expect to. But I do think that, like, with both those defensemen healthy, McAvoy and Lindholm presumably healthy, the guys that played heavy minutes toward the end of last year won't have to do that again. That Zadorov can kind of go back to being kind of more of a second or third pair kind of role where, he can focus on just being that big physical force. And he doesn't have to be relied upon to be out there on the ice as much. And I think it makes Peak's job a little bit easier. Lowry, I'm curious about what his development looks like. I think is a guy that clearly has tremendous skill from an offensive standpoint. But clearly I think has a ways to go with how he plays defensively, and the hope is maybe with a little bit more structure, you could see him improve his defensive game a little bit. I think there is some concern that, he may not get marketably better defensively, but at least could be good enough so that the Bruins can be confident in him in maybe kind of a sheltered role defensively. So, I think the good news is, I think most of the Bruins' defense is like set. So it's not like they have to revamp the entire way that they play defense. They have some kind of foundation there defensively and presumably in goal as well. And I do think that that's kind of how the Kings are set as a team that are kind of more of a defensive structured team, rely on the defense and goaltending. And, hopefully if Swayman improves and plays the way that we expect, that defense and goaltending, is like more stable and more solid. I do think that really the difference is with this team, as we all know, is kind of that secondary scoring and who can be counted on to put pucks in the net outside of Pastrnak and Geeky, Pavel Zacha, and the few guys that are still here. What do the Bruins do in the offseason? Who do they try to bring in to be able to, help out David Pastrnak and help out, the goal scoring? Because really, I think that's what's going to make the difference with this team in terms of whether they get back to being a contending team. It's defensively, if they're healthy and Swayman is back to being what we expect, they really should have no problem being a good, sound defensive team. But I do think it's offensively, and I think that's where the hope is, that Marco Sturm can kind of be there to develop some of the younger forwards. Somebody like Lysell, curious to see where he fits in. Do the Bruins try to do the best they can to kind of put him in a goal scoring role? Because I think maybe this production didn't exactly show it at the end of the season, but I did think Lysell was really starting to kind of figure it out at the NHL level. So I would hope that the Bruins are able to put him in a position where he can succeed and they're not trying to bury him on the depth chart. So I think definitely curious about Lysell in terms of what he can do with training camp and preseason. Hopefully can get some good looks. I think, again, a lot's going to depend on who they bring in this summer in terms of guys that can score. I'm curious about that seventh overall pick. I'm not sure if the Bruins do what they can to try to move up higher into the draft. Do they try to get into that top five and try to do what they can to acquire a player that they feel could help right away? Because I think at number seven, you're probably looking at a guy that may not be ready to help the team right away in the next year or two. So, I think that that is definitely a possibility that they look to move up. I think the other part about Marco Sturm that I'm kind of not sure about, the power play unit that he had in the AHL was kind of just okay. And I think this is a Bruins team that really needs to do the best they can to figure out, how to have a more productive power play. Because I think, this is a team that I think I'm not sure what they're going to look like at the start of the season, but you just remembered how that power play really didn't have a lot of other options other than, feeding it to Pasternak for one-timers. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what that power play unit looks like. Do the Bruins play, Lowry or Lindholm at that number one unit? I think I would much rather prefer that than somebody like McAvoy. I think I've talked at length on this program about, McAvoy just not being as much of a willing shooter as he should be. And I just feel like hopefully the Bruins are a team that recognizes that they need to do everything they can to get pucks and bodies to the net, and kind of not worry about really quality of shots and kind of just worry about the volume, because I think that that's presumably the kind of game that they're going to try to play. If Marco Sturm is a coach that prioritizes playing, low scoring defensive games, you want to do all you can to kind of get those kind of greasy and grimy goals. And I feel like that starts and ends with, having defensemen, especially on the power play, that are unafraid to just get the puck to the net in any way. And I just feel like for some reason, Charlie is a little bit gun shy sometimes. And I feel like they need somebody with an aggressive shoot first mentality like Torrey Krug. And I feel like you remember how the Bruins power plays were so good back in the day because a guy like Torrey Krug would just be firing shots on goal. And I just feel like if they have a person like Lowry or have a player like Lowry or a player like Lindholm that's not afraid to get puck to the net, I feel like that's where you're going to start seeing some improvements so that the Bruins are not just a, one-dimensional unit on the power play, where it's not just feeding the puck to Pasternak for one-timers. It's getting the puck to the net from the defense, Lindholm in the bumper. So it's like important to have different kind of options. So that will be interesting to see. But I do think that I am curious to see who the Bruins bring in terms of assistance. It's unclear to me, I think, whether Jay Leach will be back. So I feel like there is definitely room that the Bruins could bring in an assistant or two, Chris Kelly, I don't think will be back. And I feel like, but we already know that Joe Sacco will be in New York with the Rangers. So I feel like at least the Bruins will have a couple of new assistants. So it'll be interesting to see, who Stern brings in. But I think, as I've kind of said multiple times throughout this kind of coaching search process, is for me, the Bruins, it almost doesn't really matter who the coach is behind the bench. It really matters how they build out the rest of this roster in the summer. What do they do to, help mitigate the scoring issues that they had last season? That, can you rely on some secondary scorers? Because I think, Pastrnak and Geeky are going to do their thing, but it's like you need guys that are going to be able to, put in 20 to 25 goals that you can, be, pretty confident in. So I feel like overall, I do like the hire. I think it's a smart hire to go with a person that I think has coached at varying levels, but obviously, hasn't been a head coach at the NHL level. But I think the Olympic experience helps, the AHL experience helps in different ways. And I think I like the idea of going with a person that's never been a head coach before, because I think it means that this person might have some new, fresh ideas and isn't somebody that's, been around coaching for 20 years and kind of exactly the kind of strategy that they're going to implement. Not that that's bad necessarily, but it's like I feel like with the way the NHL is moving and the way the Bruins want to move, is they want to try to, hopefully bring in somebody that, has some newer, fresher ideas. And I think you have a better chance of that if you're hiring somebody who's never been a head coach before. So, I think people are going to look, people are going to complain about this any way that they can, but I just feel like I'm not going to really listen or understand people that want to say that, oh, it's just same old, the person that they know. It's like there's no connection to the Bruins other than he played for the team. So I don't know. That's just it's kind of a strange thing to me, but I do like the hire, and I think the first step in the right direction for, improving this team in the off season. So I think that's going to do it for the Bruins. We're going to talk a little Red Sox here. Came off a very solid weekend against the Yankees with the offense really coming through with 21 runs over their last two games, scoring 27 runs in three games. So I think, hopefully offensively, maybe things are starting to turn up for this team. They had five home runs last night. Really good to see Christian Campbell get a couple big hits in this series. Had the home run last night, an RBI single, and a couple more hits on Saturday. So I think, it's a good solid weekend for this team. And I think it's, for me, at this point, it's, as I've talked about, it's hard to be as, optimistic, because I do feel like there are kind of, limits to how good they can be. I think especially without Bregman, who kind of seems to be, really attacking his rehab at this point. And so maybe he's back sooner than we think, but I feel like for this team offensively, if they are still going the way that they are with the lineups kind of being all over the place, then it's, hard to expect much. But when the team is hitting with runners in scoring position, they're hitting home runs and, kind of making you feel good, then maybe things could be different and things could change. There still are tremendous flaws with this team, but I think it still should, you still should be pleased with their effort this weekend that, okay, they're going up against the Yankees team that's, been very, very solid this season, withstanding a lot of injuries. But I thought the Red Sox really were just outstanding offensively in this series. Now, some pitching left a little bit to be desired. I don't think the starting pitching was tremendous this weekend, but I think the Red Sox were able to do enough, especially in the last two games, to, give enough run support to some starters that, didn't pitch extraordinarily well. I think with Dobbins pitched fine last night. Crochet, I think, had one of his weaker outings this season, but the Red Sox, obviously were able to pick him up. But I think really impressed with the offense in the last two games. And I feel like if this team is going to, stay in contention or stay in any kind of contention, they're going to need the offense to be able to perform, close to this pretty regularly. Now, is this team going to be able to score 11 runs a game? No, probably not. But I think, it's good to see kind of those offensive explosions. I think at a time where offense has kind of been a bit of an issue with this team, that I think they're still kind of finding their way without Bregman, without Casas, who's, obviously going to be out for the season. And so, they're going to have to make do with what they have. I do think that, as we've kind of talked about, it's been time that Roman Anthony's been as gets called up, and it's kind of, infuriating at this point that it seems like this team is not doing everything they can to be as competitive as they can, if that makes sense. That it's almost like we're not utilizing all the resources we have to make this team as competitive as we can. And it just kind of is almost insane to me that we've had a front office tell us that at the beginning of the season, oh, our goal is to win the AL East, our goal is to win 95 games. And we're basically, not being as resourceful as we can by, not calling up the best prospect, not only in the Red Sox organization, it's the best prospect in baseball. And it just seems like there just doesn't seem to be a like good enough, reasonable reason to why Roman Anthony's not in Boston right now. So, I just, you can only beat a dead horse so many times, but I think it's past time for the Red Sox to find a way to get him up here. I really don't think that there's any kind of excuse. And I know that I've talked about, Seydon Rafaela, that like probably could be a utility player at this point. Obviously is outstanding defensively, and I think that's the only thing that gives maybe some people pause about calling Anthony up, because Rafaela has been really good defensively, but gives you pretty much nothing offensively. Yes, I know he homered three times last week, but I feel like calling up Anthony gives you a better chance to be a better team offensively, and they're just choosing not to bring him up for reasons that really don't make sense. So, it's frustrating that it's gotten to this point, because you look at somebody like Campbell, somebody like Meyer, who, really, they didn't play many games in Worcester. They kind of got called up pretty immediately, and it's like Roman Anthony's played like 90 games in AAA, and it's like, for what purpose? So I think I don't want to spend, too much time on this, but it just is kind of puzzling to me that the Red Sox are not doing, everything they can to try to stay competitive, especially without somebody like Bregman. I know that there are ways that they can get Anthony onto the team. There's really no excuse to be like, oh, where's the place for him? It's like the best prospect in baseball. Like, you figure out a way to fit him on the team. Really shouldn't be that difficult. So, I do think it's been great to see Marcelo Meyer, get opportunities in the big leagues. Kind of strange that he didn't play or didn't start the, two games of this Yankees series against lefties. It's kind of just like, I don't know, can we let the kids play at a certain point? So that kind of was frustrating, but good to see Marcelo hit his first career home run on Friday night. So that was a pretty cool moment. Just kind of a exciting prospect that we've heard lots about. So it's great to see him be able to get opportunities, but it's like there should be more opportunities. He really should be playing every single day, you know, whether it's third base, second base, wherever you're placing him. He should be in the lineup every day. I understand that, you know, Abraham Toro has played some good baseball as of late, you know, had a really good weekend. But it's kind of like, you know, I don't know. At a certain point, you want to see what your you know, younger, highly touted prospect can do. And it's not a disrespect to Toro because he has played well, but it's like, again, there has to be a way that he plays every day. I'm not really sure why he's sitting against lefties because it's like he's played, what, eight games in Major League Baseball to this point, and it's just, it just seems kind of strange that, you know, he didn't start. You know, obviously came in as a pinch hitter on Saturday night, which was good to see, but it just seems like, again, this is a team that's not, you know, doing everything they can to, you know, field the best, most competitive team that gives them the best chance to win. So, you know, it just is concerning at a certain point that, you know, you don't feel that, I don't know, you don't feel that 12 games for Meyer. You don't feel like the front office really is as serious as they say about, you know, competing and, you know, wanting to win the division and things like that. You know, granted, this is certainly a team that's had its fair share of injuries. You know, I think that you've had certain guys that have been ineffective as well. You know, the pitching staff has not nearly been as good as you would expect. But I think it's good to see the offense kind of, you know, come through and pick up the starting pitching, but it's like, man, they need that unit to be so much better than they've been, and it really doesn't seem like there's any consistency outside of Crochet, who, you know, has been excellent. You know, ERA is like 2.3 or something like that, and you've really not gotten any kind of consistent outings from any of the other starters. You know, Bayo has been up and down. Bueller has been up and down lately. You know, Hauk obviously had that terrible start, and he's, I think, working his way back from the injured list. And Cutter Crawford, I think, had a setback recently in his rehab, and so you might not see him for a bit. You know, Giolito, I think, again, another guy that just has no consistency. Like, you have no idea what to expect. You know, he could give you five, six innings where he gives up a run or two, but then he can have an outing where he gives up seven, eight runs and can't finish two innings. You know, so it's like they just desperately need someone in that rotation to pitch deep into games and be able to do it consistently. Because I think the bullpen, you know, it's not really been a good bullpen this year either. You know, all the blown saves, all kind of some ineffectiveness at certain points, you know, outside of Chapman, who's been probably their best relief pitcher, you know, has been almost automatic in save situations. And it seems like they just have been unable to get games to him late. And it just, again, goes back to those kind of key areas that the Red Sox have just not been good in, you know, blown saves, errors, hitting with runners on base and in scoring position, and, you know, starters' ERAs and, you know, starting pitchers that have had considerable issues in the first inning. And Crochet is not even, you know, blameless there. You know, he's had some issues in first innings as well, giving up home runs. So it's like there needs to be consistency from the starting pitching, or else, you know, your offense is, again, not going to be able to score 10 or 11 runs every single game. And so it's like the best teams, you know, have their pitching and offense and defense, you know, all working in tandem and all being strong at the same time. And the Red Sox just, they're not good enough in those three areas for on a consistent basis. The defense, again, consistently has been bad. the starting pitching has consistently just not been good enough. And, offensively, as good as this weekend series has been, and look, it's always great and always positive when you can beat the Yankees. It always feels good. But it's almost like it's hard to have high expectations for this group when it just seems like it's too inconsistent, and yet the front office is not doing everything they can to, field the best, most complete version of the team. And it just seems like for reasons that don't make sense, they're just not putting the best team on the field for some reason. Again, reasons that don't make sense. So I think, you hope that this weekend series gives them a little bit of momentum, going into some games at home this week. So they have a 3-game set against the Rays starting tonight, and then the Yankees are back in town over the weekend. So I think, again, big opportunity to build off of some momentum, something that this team has not been able to do really at all this season. So, the hope is that it starts now, in early June with the Red Sox. 3 games under 500, 4.5 back of the wild card, 8.5 back of the division. It's not insurmountable, but I think for this team, if they want to be competitive, it kind of starts, now. And I think that they recognize that. And so that's why you hope you can build off of a solid, weekend series. Really impressed. Someone else that I was going to highlight is Carlos Narvaez, who seems like it's been a godsend for this Red Sox team this season, that comes in as a, with a minor league contract, and has been one of the best catchers in baseball this season. Homered last night with a 3-run shot, has been excellent defensively, and really has, taken that number one catcher spot, and has just been tremendous. It's been, one of the Red Sox' best players. Outside of Bregman and Crochet, Chapman, I think he's been one of their best, most consistent players this season. So I'm going to make sure to give props to him, and maybe potentially could even be an all-star, as that was mentioned on the broadcast on Saturday night. That, could be a possibility as a first-time all-star. So just a tremendous season that he's having. So Red Sox, again, starting a 3-game series with the Rays tonight at 7:10. Brian Bello will start the series, and then Giolito will go tomorrow night, and then Buehler Wednesday, and then off day Thursday, and the Red Sox will host the Yankees with Crochet, Dobbins, and Bello going for those 3 games against the Yankees. And then the Red Sox will be off on the West Coast. They will go to Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, take them almost to the end of the month of June. So I think that's going to do it for the Red Sox. We're going to get to a little Patriots as mandatory mini camps open this week. There'll be sessions open to the media for a couple days this week. So obviously it'll be a good look at some off-season work the Patriots are doing, as this will be the last time that they get together for off-season activities until training camp next month. So it'd be interesting to see what kinds of things you notice. I don't want to say it like this, but it is usually the time of year where, injuries can occur. We've seen some injuries happen already with certain guys on different teams. Jelani Tavai, I think, suffered some kind of leg injury last week, so I think that definitely bears monitoring, as he's a guy that definitely could be an important part to their linebacking core this season. So I think definitely got to watch out for that. I think also, speaking of injury, it'll be interesting to see Stefon Diggs and his continued, recovery from the ACL last season. I think in the session last week that he returned to practice, I think looked pretty good, looked pretty spry, and I think that that's definitely a good sign. I think that personally, I expect big things from him this season. I'm not expecting obviously the, all pro receiver level that he was at maybe 3 years ago, but I still think that he's got enough in the tank to, be that number one option for Drake May. Now, obviously, hopefully, the knee is rehabbing as well as we hope. And he doesn't need to start the season on the PUP list, which would cause him to miss a number of games. But, I think the early returns on him are good. It'll be interesting to see, when Terrell Williams returns to the sideline. I know he's been dealing with a health issue, so he's been away from the team. So I think it would be nice to see him around the team at some point when he's, healthy enough to join the team. So that kind of would be significant if, joined the team for for any kind of off-season workouts. I think otherwise, curious about that offensive line grouping. What does that look like? The wide receiver core, what does that look like? I think those are really the two most interesting positions that, will be worth watching this offseason and into training camp. The kicker position, I was kind of curious about with Borregales, the kicker that the Patriots had drafted, but it seems like he's had some really good practices so far, so kind of seems like he will likely be the guy. So I'm kind of curious about that as well. But I think, yeah, offensive line, wide receiver, defensively, I'm not, there's not really an area that I'm concerned with. Although, as I mentioned, the Tavai injury does kind of bear monitoring. If he has to miss some time this season or in training camp, what opportunities does that open for, some of the other linebackers that they have? Because clearly, I think this is a group that is kind of in flux a little bit with the loss of Bentley, who I think was, really important team leader. And so it's like, how do they go about, replacing that leadership, so to speak? Spillane, I think, really liked that signing in the offseason. Christian Ellis will be back. I was really happy with his performance last year at times. And obviously Jennings, I really like as a player. Jack Gibbons, they signed. I do think that, Chiasson, who they signed, and Swinson, who they drafted, those are kind of more pass rush guys. But I think I'm more curious about, those guys that are going to play in the middle and kind of be the coverage guys. Spillane, I think, is an outstanding tackler, but it's like if Tavai goes down and has to miss, has to miss a significant amount of time, who steps in to kind of be that next man up sort of thing. So I think that definitely does bear some watching. So, I think, again, as I always say, and always remind, other people and remind myself too, that, any kind of statistics that you see in these types of off-season scenarios, whether it's mandatory mini camps, OTAs, or, training camp, you kind of take the statistics with a grain of salt. Now, of course, if, there can be days where the offense just isn't clicking, and there are days where the defense is playing really well. So it's like, I kind of, again, take those statistics with a grain of salt that it's like, somebody performs badly, it's not necessarily an indicator of anything, to me personally. That's just the way that I look at it. Other people certainly look at it other ways, but I think it's important for me to keep in mind at least that, like, hey, it's just training camp statistics, or it's off-season and training camp statistics that, it's may not be an indicator of how things go when the games, start to matter. So I think it's going to do it for the Patriots. Going to do some quick revolution notes as they were off this week. They will face Cincinnati this week at Gillette, or this weekend at Gillette, I think is June 14th, which is Saturday. Yes, that's right. So the Revs will play FC Cincinnati at home, and then they will close out the month of June later this month. Or yeah, we'll close out the month of June with games against Nashville and Colorado on the 25th and the 28th. So Revolution currently 11th place in the East, 2 points back of a playoff spot, and they will play FC Cincinnati, who is currently second place in the East. Although it is interesting, the Revolution have a better goal differential than Cincinnati does, so that's kind of interesting. But Revs will be home for the next three, which is great, as they had quite the away schedule to start the season, or to start the season. So it'd be good to see them back at home at Gillette, and hopefully they can keep climbing up the Eastern Conference standings. So I think it's going to do it for the Revs. No Celtics news really. The only thing I was going to touch on was, and I kind of talked about this a little bit on the mailbag, that Derek White is somebody that should be staying, like, at all costs. I feel like if there's one player that absolutely needs to stay, it's Derek White. And I think it's good to know that there are reports that multiple teams have reached out to the Celtics about Derek White, and Brad Stevens has rebuffed every single one of those trade offers. So, I think that's a good sign that Brad Stevens also believes that Derek White is indispensable and should not even be considered to be moved. And I think, he's a guy that, depending on the movement of some other guys in this offseason, we'll see. He is going to be a hugely important player for the Celtics team this upcoming season, especially if Jason is going to miss the entire season. Jalen, chances are that he misses a decent amount of the season if he chooses to get surgery on that knee. So it's like keeping somebody like Derek White makes a lot of sense, because it's like, sure, the Celtics probably want to get under that second apron, but it's like you still need to be able to kind of have a team and players that, you can count on to try to keep the team competitive as best you can. So Derek White should be with the Celtics at all costs. I don't think there ever should be a scenario where they consider moving thing, or they should definitely not consider moving him. So we'll get to some NBA notes here. Obviously, the Thunder evening the series last night with the Pacers, 123-107. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 34 points in game two, I think is you watch him play and it's just ridiculous how easy he makes the game look. And really just had a vintage performance last night. It was also outstanding in game one with 38 points, but obviously the Pacers, able to make those clutch shots down the stretch. It's really have not seen anything like it with this Pacers team and their ability to be able to, knock down those shots, make the big plays in the clutch moments, and literally just do it over and over, that it's like you get down to a game where they're, down 7, 8 points in the last minute of a game, and you're like, okay, they legitimately still have a chance. So, obviously did not happen in game two, as the Thunder, really took it to the Pacers, which I wasn't surprised. I think the Thunder really felt like they gave away that first game. So good for them to be able to bounce back and even the series. So game three of the finals will be from Indianapolis Wednesday night, 8:30 start. So extra day off for travel for both of these teams. So some other NBA notes. Zach Edey is likely to be out for the start of the season with ankle surgeries. He suffered an injury in off-season workouts. And also the big news last week, Tom Thibodeau out as the Knicks coach, which is a little bit surprising to me. I think just considering the success that he had with the Knicks, but I guess the Knicks must feel that they need a different coach to help them kind of get over the top. So very curious what happens next with them. I feel like Michael Malone could be an option for them. Obviously, the coach that was let go by the Nuggets, days before the playoffs. I feel like that could be a possibility for a Knicks team that's trying to, get over that top and, win an NBA championship. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's who they hire to be their next head coach, but obviously we will see. I will go over to some NHL notes. The Stars firing Pete DeBoer after coming up short in the Western Conference Finals for the third straight year. So that was kind of, I think I was a little bit surprised just because Dallas has had a good amount of postseason success in the last couple of years, but they might feel kind of like the Knicks in the NBA that they might need a different coach to be able to kind of put them over the top. So that was kind of interesting. I know that there was maybe some rumors out there that the Bruins may have been interested in DeBoer had he gotten fired, which he did. But I think it just, at that point, I think the Bruins had kind of already made up their mind with Marco Sturm. So it'd be interesting if it takes over in Dallas after DeBoer gets let go. So game three of the Stanley Cup final tonight in Florida. Oilers and Panthers split the first two games in Edmonton, both games going to overtime. Just tremendous entertainment those first two games. Oilers winning the first game, and then the Panthers winning game two. Old friend Brad Marchand with the overtime winner, double overtime in game two, had also scored a shorthanded goal previously in that game. So just a tremendous series so far. Fully expect game three to be absolutely crazy. So game three in Florida tonight. And then game four will be Thursday. I know that there's a lot out there about people supporting Brad Marchand as a member of the Panthers, and wanting to see him do well, which it's like, I'll be honest here, I'm not gonna sit here and say that I don't support him, because obviously that's crazy, but just, I don't know, being the Bruins fan in me, it's a little difficult to root for a Panthers team that I have quite an amount of disdain for. But I think if the Panthers do win, good for Brad. He deserves it. But I certainly am rooting for the Oilers. I think it would be great to see Connor McDavid win a cup. I think also want to support Trent Frederick as well, who's with the Oilers. So either way, it's going to be a tremendous rest of the series, which I think really should be a series that even if you are somebody that casually watches hockey, you should definitely tune in, because I think this has been a great series so far, and I think will continue to be a great series. So we'll get to some baseball notes here. We'll take a look at the standings. Obviously, as you mentioned, the Red Sox, 8.5 games out of first place in the AL East, with the Yankees at 39 and 25, leading Tampa Bay and Toronto by 4.5, and then the Red Sox 8.5 back. In the Central, Tigers still lead and have the best record in baseball atop the AL Central. 43 and 24, 7-game lead over the Twins. And then in the West, Houston leads 2.5 games over Seattle. In the National League East, the Mets lead the East at 42 and 24, 4.5 games ahead of the Phillies. The Cubs in first in the Central, 4 games up on the Cardinals. And then the Dodgers lead the West by a game over the Padres and the Giants. So we'll now take a look at some NFL notes, some big-time player movement over the last couple of days. Aaron Rodgers finally coming to terms with the Steelers on a 1-year contract. That was just ridiculous that that took that long. But he's with the Steelers now officially, so Patriots will play the Steelers, I think, in the first couple weeks of the season. So Patriots will be playing Aaron Rodgers again, which is like the third or fourth year in a row, I think, that they've played him in the regular season. So that will kind of be significant. But I do think, the Steelers, I don't expect them to be like a world of difference than what they were last season. Rodgers, I think, still, has the talent to be able to be like a solid quarterback, but he's not anywhere near the MVP level that he was a couple of years ago. So I don't really expect that this is going to seriously move the needle for the Steelers. They at least have a quarterback that's not Mason Rudolph or Skylar Thompson, so that's at least significant. But it's just, I don't know if this move really changes things, because it's like you look at that division with Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow, it's like, I don't know if the Steelers are, they're the third best team in that division, probably. But it's just like, again, I don't think that this move moves the needle much for them. So the Texans are going to sign Nick Chubb, who's available as a free agent, so he will sign with the Texans. I think the Texans getting some help in that backfield. And then this morning, the Packers releasing Jaire Alexander, cornerback, which is kind of shocking, to be perfectly honest. Alexander's one of the best corners in the league, so be interesting to see if there's a team that picks him up. So it's just always interesting this time of year when there are guys that kind of get shockingly released, and it's like, oh, okay, guys like that can come available literally at any point. So it's just kind of wild when that happens. So I think, talk a little WNBA here. The Sky's Courtney Vandersloot is out for the rest of the season with a torn ACL. So definitely a tough break there for the Sky. We'll take a look the standings here. Well, actually, we'll take a look at some games on the schedule. One game tonight, Golden State against Los Angeles at 10. Take a look at the standings here in the East. New York still leads the conference 8-0. They have yet to lose a 19-point differential this season, so they have been absolutely dominating the rest of the league. Minnesota, though, not to be outdone, 9-0 on the season, 10.7-point differential, so they've been a little bit better. They've also been as good in the point differential department. So unfortunately, the local team, Connecticut, 2-7 on the season. They recently just lost to the Mystics last night, 104 to 67 the final. So they've had a struggle to start this season, which I think, with all the player movement, kind of to be expected for them, unfortunately. So I think that's going to do it for the sports this week, although we do have a sports theme top five for you folks this week. So I was able to attend the Worcester Red Sox game yesterday out at Polar Park, second time that I've been out there. So I thought it would be a good week to do my top five sports venues. So would like to say that it was a great game to get out there yesterday. Blue Sox won 5-4. Did get to see Roman Anthony in person, which was pretty cool. I was there with a friend of the pod, Derek Welch. So two of us had a great time yesterday. So I think that's where we will do the top five this week. So I'm looking at sports venues, so arenas and stadiums that I've seen games at in my 29 years of living. So I will start with number five. Bit of kind of an out there suggest, or well, maybe it's not out there. I think a lot of people would consider this place to be a great ballpark, and that is Camden Yards in Baltimore. I was lucky enough to go to a Red Sox game there for my 13th birthday. So that was definitely a a great park, really nice neighborhood park, just really beautiful. And I think one of the best parks in baseball. A lot of people would agree. Just a really nice park. So I think that was a good place to start. My top five. This was a game we went to. Red Sox unfortunately lost, but definitely a great experience to go to a game there, take a road trip to Baltimore, go see the Red Sox. So number four, sticking with the baseball, Fenway has got to be in my top five. So it's number four for me, and maybe it's a little low on the list just because I've been to so many games there. I know all the stuff about the history and things like that, which it is pretty cool. Like, I think I should consider myself lucky that I live in a place like Boston and can go to a place like Fenway that is, so rich with history, with different little facts about the ballpark and about the team and things like that. So, definitely had to be in my top five. I've seen some, interesting games there from time to time. I think it's the place I've been to the most in terms of, sporting events. So, I've not been back for a couple of years, but it is definitely still a place that is worthwhile to go to. So number three, I have a younger brother who attended Clemson University, so had to put Memorial Stadium on here, which is the football stadium. Went to go see Clemson play Florida State in the fall of 2023. Just a ridiculous atmosphere, and obviously, coming from an area of the country where college football is really not on a lot of people's radars, going down there to experience a football game is just absolutely unbelievable. And a place like Clemson, Death Valley, one of the, I think, premier stadiums in college football, just was an unbelievable experience. Unfortunately, Clemson lost the game, but just a tremendous atmosphere, with the players touching the rock, running down the hill. Really one of the coolest traditions in sports. So I definitely had to have this in my top five. So my younger brother Carter will definitely be excited that I had it top three. But I think just nothing like watching a football game in a place like that in the South. Just unbelievable energy in that stadium. So number two, obviously, as a lot of the listeners know, I'm a huge, huge hockey fan. That, hockey is my number one sport that I love the most. So this is where I went with number two, Aganis Arena, the Boston University. Just love that rink. Not a bad seat in the house in that rink. Been to that rink plenty of times for a lot of BU games. So I definitely had to have it in my top five. I've seen some great games, seen some great players throughout the years. So definitely had to have this in my top five. So number one, I had to go with the Garden. I think just being a big hockey fan, have seen some great Bruins games there. I've obviously seen my fair share of Celtics games as well. Seen plenty of legends of the game, Tim Duncan, LeBron James. I've seen some unbelievable games with both the Celtics and the Bruins. So I think for me, that was a clear number one. I think the place that I've had the most fun as a sports fan. So I think Garden's got to be number one. So now we'll take a look at some honorable mentions here. Harvard Stadium is on here, although this is kind of interesting because never saw a football game at Harvard Stadium. I've only been there to cover high school lacrosse, but definitely an iconic stadium. That was really, really cool to be able to, witness a sporting event at that place. Gillette Stadium, obviously, gotta have on here, although haven't been to Gillette for many Patriot games. I've only been to two, preseason game and then a playoff game. Playoff game obviously was significant. The 2011 AFC Championship, Patriots beat the Ravens. Billy Cundiff missed that field goal. I mean, one of the most electric sporting events I've ever been to, but really have only experienced Revolution games otherwise at Gillette. And Those are fun for sure, but I think I didn't quite have it in my top five as the sheer number of times is not, a whole lot at Gillette, but obviously that one playoff game was unbelievable, so had to put it in my honorable mention. Polar Park, in which, same place we were talking about where I was yesterday, really like the park. That really great location. A lot of fun minor league baseball stadium. So that was that definitely has to be an honorable mention. It was a really great time to be out there yesterday. I think it's great that the Red Sox are, brought a team out to Worcester. They're not down in Pawtucket where, kind of a little bit harder to get to. But I think definitely a great idea that they're in Worcester, great park, great atmosphere out there. So my last one here, Nationals Park in DC. I've been a couple of times. Really nice location of that stadium. And I've seen, saw a pretty historic moment also when I went to Nationals Park, one of the two times that I've been that the Nationals were playing the Angels. Albert Pujols hit his 499th and 500th home run in that park in the same game. Was lucky enough to be there, so that had to definitely be in the honorable mention. So I figure that was a good top five to do this week. Really great to be back with you folks this week. Looking forward to Guest Friday later this week, where we will be talking some PLL. So we will check in with you folks then.